Welcome to the Confluence Investment Management Geopolitical Biweekly Report for January 26th, 2026. I'm Phil Adler. After a year in office, it is becoming a little bit easier to categorize the Trump administration's foreign policy and to build an investment strategy around it. Confluence Chief Market Strategist Patrick Piran Hernandez joins us today to discuss his latest report titled Blocks, Spheres of Influence, Empires, and Colonial Systems. First, Patrick, you make the case that America's foreign policy is evolving to a new kind of imperialism. What do you mean?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Phil. The key idea here is that the U.S. has always exercised a kind of soft power imperialism. In other words, informal leadership through institutions, alliances, and economic attraction rather than direct coercion. But what we've seen under President Trump's second term is something qualitatively different. In the report, I argue that the administration is shifting toward a more overt, hard power-based imperialism, where military force, coercive diplomacy, and explicit economic leverage are used to extract compliance from other countries. Now, the U.S. seizure of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in early January is a perfect example. U.S. Special Forces captured Maduro and took him to New York to face narco-terrorism charges, and President Trump openly declared that the U.S. would, quote, run the country until a safe transition could take place, unquote. This type of direct intervention, without congressional notification, signals exactly the transition described in our report, a move toward hard power imperialism coupled with neocolonial economic aims. In short, the gloves are off, the velvet is off the glove, and U.S. foreign policy is now openly about controlling strategic regions and resources.
And Patrick, you also see parallels to the British colonialism of the 1800s. In what way?
Great question. Traditional British imperial policy was aimed at guaranteed markets, secure access to raw materials, and political dominance, often exercised through local proxies. What we're seeing now is a U.S. model that mirrors this logic. It's built around control over supply chains, especially critical minerals and advanced semiconductors, and direct influence over governance, as we now see in Venezuela, where an interim government aligned with U.S. interests has been installed following Maduro's capture. Importantly, the new U.S. model involves prioritization of commercial gains for metropolitan power. In other words, U.S. multinationals. This is exactly what British colonialism did. It created captive markets and secure sources of industrial inputs. So today, the U.S. is making similar moves, including trade deals, subsidies, and direct security actions designed to shape foreign economic behavior in its favor. So the parallel is not just metaphorical, it's structural.
Well, the Trump administration would not be driving these changes without some popular support. Where is this support coming from?
We think the support comes primarily from U.S. working-class voters who felt left behind during the decades of globalization that defined soft power hegemony. They associate the old system with deindustrialization, offshoring, immigration pressure, and stagnant wage growth. Our report shows that the U.S. working class experienced many costs under the soft power system and is now more willing to embrace a harder neocolonial approach if it promises economic security at home. The Venezuela operation has been framed domestically as a bold move to protect Americans from narco-trafficking and to restore national strength. And these messages resonate strongly with Trump's political base. So the electorate's mood helps explain why these policies have political durability.
Well, the Western Hemisphere, and I guess you would include Greenland as part of the Western Hemisphere, is a particular focus of this new thrust toward classic colonialism as a means to economic power. Where do other parts of the world fit within this policy?
Well, the Western Hemisphere remains the core. You're right about that. Trump's team clearly prefers short, secure supply chains, which is why they're trying to pull Latin America tightly into the U.S. sphere. The problem is that the Americas simply don't have enough population, market size, or mineral resources to satisfy U.S. strategic and industrial needs. For example, the Americas hold just 13% of global population. They represent just 24% of global gross domestic product on a purchasing power parity basis. Critical minerals are mostly located in Africa and the Asia Pacific. And the world's most advanced semiconductors are from Taiwan. As a result, despite the Western Hemisphere emphasis, the administration must engage in imperial policies outside the region, pulling countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and parts of Europe and the Middle East into the U.S. system, at least for now. That's why the Venezuela operation wasn't just local. We think it was also a message to China and Russia that the U.S. is reasserting control over its near abroad, in a way consistent with great power imperial systems.
Patrick, I see how the removal of Venezuelan President Maduro aligns with this new, harsher foreign policy. But I'm curious why the U.S. is supporting Maduro's vice president to head the government instead of a popular opposition leader. What's your opinion?
Well, Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's vice president, was indeed sworn in as interim leader immediately after the U.S. operation, but the U.S. rationale makes sense in an imperial logic kind of framework. Here's why. First, in this logic, stability is more important than democracy. From a neocolonial perspective, Washington prioritizes operational stability. Rodriguez, as part of the regime, understands the state machinery and can keep the government functioning even if she's not pro-U.S. ideologically. Another consideration is that there's the issue of opposition fragmentation. Even though Maria Corina Machado, the opposition's moral figurehead, has overwhelming popular support, about 72% approval in a 2025 poll, Trump dismissed her as lacking sufficient internal respect, perhaps because she represents a more independent, less controllable path forward. And finally, there's the issue of continuity of control. Installing a familiar bureaucratic insider makes it easier for the U.S. to run the country, as Trump said. It mirrors historical colonial transitions where local elites served as administrative intermediaries. In sum, the choice wasn't about democratic legitimacy. It was about ease of management.
This evolving foreign policy, Patrick, seems to set up a fierce competition with China to bring countries within the U.S. sphere of influence. Confluence has developed a methodology to predict where countries around the world may land. Which countries are on the fence right now?
Well, first, Phil, I need to state a caveat. The bloc system that we've described in recent years may take some time to morph into something more reflective of the U.S.'s new neo-imperialist and neo-colonial system. As that happens, the fence-sitters, or the countries that may be tempted to change sides, will likely be those that rely economically on China, rely militarily on the U.S., and don't want to choose. Based on our five-bloc model, countries most at risk of being contested probably include Southeast Asian states such as Vietnam, Indonesia, and Malaysia, African resource states such as Zambia, the DRC, and Namibia, Middle Eastern swing states such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and Latin American democracies such as Colombia and Chile. These states are attractive targets for both the U.S. and China because of either strategic location or critical resources. Our report also notes that China is itself building a neocolonial infrastructure via the Belt and Road Initiative, setting up a global great game between the two powers. The Venezuela operation was partly intended as a signal to Beijing, essentially saying, hey, the Western Hemisphere is off limits to you.
I was curious, where does the recent U.S. support for opposition within Iran fit within this evolving U.S. foreign policy?
Well, Iran fits into a broader pattern. The U.S. is targeting revisionist powers aligned with China and Russia. Supporting Iranian opposition groups serves several purposes. For example, it weakens a member of the anti-U.S. coalition. Iran is closely tied to Russia and China, so undermining Tehran constrains the broader authoritarian bloc. Pressuring Iran also may help protect the Persian Gulf energy system. Even in a neocolonial framework, the U.S. still needs stable global energy flows. And finally, pushing on Iran demonstrates U.S. resolve outside the Western Hemisphere. Our report explains that the U.S. can't retreat from global power projection because adversaries can threaten the U.S. from anywhere in the world, especially with longer-range weapons and cyber tools.
Patrick, I want to follow up on an earlier question regarding support among U.S. voters for this new foreign policy. The competition with China looks like a very long-term affair. Are you confident that the United States, with our potential to change the political party in power every 2 years, will remain faithful to this policy long enough to deliver results?
Well, this is actually a crucial question. Historically, U.S. foreign policy has swung dramatically with leadership changes, but the new imperial turn seems to have strong working-class support, and the economic logic, reshoring, supply chain security, and industrial policy, now enjoys bipartisan momentum. Even critics of Trump's Venezuela operation acknowledge it's one of the most consequential geopolitical moves in modern hemispheric history, with effects that will not easily be undone. So yes, I believe the larger structural forces, in other words, economic insecurity, geopolitical fragmentation, and great power competition, mean this more assertive colonial-style foreign policy will survive beyond any one presidency.
Well, the investment winners from this new foreign policy appear to be many, including European stocks, particularly defense stocks and precious metals. But you are now more optimistic about American defense stocks and U.S. large cap stocks in general. Why?
Well, there's three key reasons. First, it now looks like the administration has decided on a massive U.S. defense buildup to protect its evolving neo-imperialist and neo-colonial system. After initially signaling defense cuts, President Trump reversed course and is now calling for a 50% increase in defense spending. That's hugely bullish for U.S. defense contractors. Now, second, there's heightened U.S. pressure for global economic and regulatory reform. The administration is pushing other nations, especially EU governments, to deregulate their economies, which should open up foreign markets to U.S. firms. And then finally, large-cap multinationals are likely to benefit from U.S. government protection and from being better able to navigate in a fractured world. In a neocolonial environment, only big firms have the scale, the lobbying networks, and the resilience to navigate geopolitical realignments. So yes, we're more bullish on U.S. large-cap and defense stocks than we were before.
And I can see how your list of countries which might move under the U.S. umbrella would be very useful from an investment standpoint. Where are the best opportunities right now?
Well, we think the best opportunities cluster in three different areas. The first is Europe. We think deregulation pressure, increased defense spending, and political realignments mean European equities have strong tailwinds, especially industrials, defense, and infrastructure. The second attractive area is Latin America. After all, U.S. pressure will push these countries toward policies favoring market liberalization, which could boost their asset values. The only caveat is that investors must be selective. After all, U.S. firms may eventually buy out the most attractive local companies in Latin America. And finally, we like U.S. mega caps, especially in tech, energy, and digital services. These firms will have the full backing of U.S. foreign policy as Washington works to secure their global sales channels.
Patrick, one more question. We've seen how a weakening U.S. dollar can boost foreign markets. But you make the case now that the U.S. drive to dominate Latin America makes predictions about the dollar's direction more difficult. Why?
Yes, and that's because two forces are now colliding. First, there's long-term dollar weakening driven by fracturing supply chains, inflation volatility, higher U.S. debt loads, and increased policy uncertainty. At the same time, the new U.S. neo-imperialist or neo-colonial system is likely to lead to rising geopolitical demand for dollars. As the U.S. extends tighter control over Latin American economies and potentially other regions, it's likely that trade, investment, and reserve practices within the U.S. system become more dollar-centric. In addition, the administration's temporary easing of tensions with China reduces immediate global risk premiums, strengthening flows into U.S. assets in the short term. As a result, the dollar's path may no longer be straightforward, and traditional FX models may become less reliable.
Thank you, Patrick. The title of this week's report is Blocks, Spheres of Influence, Empires, and Colonial Systems. You can find a link to the written report on the Confluence webpage, confluenceinvestment.com, and you'll also see there an updated table presenting where over 200 countries around the world stand regarding U.S. influence. Our discussion today is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.